Okay, I think this is the right time to start the conference. I'm Paweł Strzelecki, and I'm Vice Director of the Institute of Statistics and Demography. And in the name of the organizers, I'm really happy that you are here and we can start our conference. At the beginning, we have the welcome addresses from three persons that you will see here. So first, there will be Agnieszka Płoń-Domińczak, professor and vice rector of the SGH. Then I would like ask Anne Gauthier, and then Professor Anne Gauthier, and then Professor Katowska. Before we start, I have only one technical remark. Please don't be nervous about your internet passwords that you have received. It should work from tomorrow, but now, yeah, that's the my form of the joke at the beginning of the conference. Yeah, but for now you can use the Wi-Fi EduRoam if you have the access as the academics. So I think that from my side that's all. And I warmly welcome the speech of Vice Rector Agnieszka Płoń-Domińczak. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I have many hats, so some of you know me as a demographer, some of you know me as a person involved in servant health, aging, and retirement in Europe, some of you know me as a liaison officer in Population Europe Network, and also as a head of Institute of Statistics and Demography. So with my many hats, I would like to very warmly welcome you, not only on behalf of myself, but also on behalf of our rector, Piotr Wachowiak, and all the authorities of the Warsaw School of Economics. It is a great pleasure and honor to host the 7th GGP User Conference here in Warsaw, because, well, first, it is a very important survey. It is a very important research infrastructure, and we are really proud to be a part of the GGP research infrastructure. And we are very proud to host so many incredible people that will be presenting here during the next 2 days, but also today. So it is really a privilege and honor. And demographic changes that are related to what happens to families, to what happens to individuals, are very important for European countries, but also for Poland. We try to initiate discussion on the importance of understanding the demographic change, the consequences of demographic change, the responses to demographic change between experts and the policymakers. It's not always easy, but any kind of good ideas, good exchange, sort of loading our batteries with new approaches are important in this discussion. So for us, it will be two days of really real treat to be here, to listen to you, and to present our thoughts as well. So we are very grateful. And so today, the welcoming speech will be also given by Professor Anne Gauthier, who's the coordinator of GGP and a very good friend, and Professor Irena Elżbieta Kotowska, who is involved in the GGP Poland from the beginning, but also our mentor, former director of the Institute of Statistics and Demography, and one of the very best people that we all know here. So we are very happy that you are here and that we've managed to have this conference with so many people coming and discussing. So I think that is all. And of course, I mean, just a little brief introduction to today. So we will have a keynote speech of another very good researcher and a very good friend, and also alumni of the Warsaw School of Economics, Professor Anna Matysiak, currently from the University of Warsaw and the founder of the Interdisciplinary Center of Labor Market and Family Dynamics, LabFAM. And Anna Matysiak, sort of combines economic research, labor market research, and fertility research as an economist and demographer, and I think a sociologist to a certain extent as well. And she's incredible in creating really amazing teams and amazing ideas and amazing projects. We are very sorry not to have Anya at the Warsaw School of Economics, but we do cooperate all the time. She's also right now running ERC project that is a part of the lab fund. So we hope to listen from you on the issues of the structural labor market change due to technological change and globalization and fertility. So a topic that is also very interesting. And then we'll have the first survey on flash fashion on survey methods, followed by a small reception, and the next 2 days will come. So very warmly welcome, and in Warsaw we have a very good weather today. Tomorrow will be a little bit colder, but still I hope that you will enjoy Warsaw, not only scientifically, but also from the perspective of sites and things you can do in not that much of a free time that you will have during the conference. Thanks very much, Anne.
Thank you very much, Agnieszka. Dear friends, welcome to this seventh user conference. It's so nice to see some of you have participated in many user conferences, and some of you, I think, for the first time. It's a nice group of people. The way we have conceived the program, the way we run these conferences, is really to maximize interaction between participants. We're here to hear about your new insights into the data. Try to impress us, show us what you've been doing so hard in the past few months or last night, who knows, perhaps working on your data. But really use this time to really interact with each other, find maybe collaborators for new papers, look on new ideas, or find others who are struggling with the same issue and the same frustration that you have with your data. That's why we're here as a user community. But we would like also for you to give us feedback. We're especially interested in knowing, of course, your feedback on the new data, on the round two data, feedback on our website, on our data portal. We're in a transition period here where we're really trying to improve our service to the user community, and this feedback has to come to us. So do find in the room here, we have several people from the central hub. Do interact to them, do let them know what you find. And get involved also, find ways of getting involved. Think here about our through the social media, which is more the usual channel. But if you have ideas of how to keep the GGP really up to date, leading edge, some data innovation, do step up also to us. Step up also if you have ideas for new countries where you could help us collect data. This is why we're here. We rely on you a lot, and I wish you a wonderful conference. And thank you so much for the Warsaw School of Economics for hosting it. Thank you.
Thank you for coming here, and I'm not sure that I'm a famous person, but I'm sure that I'm an oldest person in this group. And it happens to me too often recently. But what I would like to share with you my feelings and my gratitude to Anne and the consortium board that we could meet here.
because of GGP data users. You can notice the photo of Professor Janina Jóźwiak. She was the director of the Institute for many years. She was a rector, but she was also vice president and president of IPS. And because of her activities, because of her leadership, we were strongly engaged in European community of researchers. And what was important for us to meet 20 years ago for the European Demographic Conference organized under auspices of IPS. And I'm happy that some of them were also participated in this meeting. But what makes me even more pleased from today's meeting that many of my colleagues attended this conference as students, and now they are professors. They are leading persons among Polish demographers, but also in this European community. And we are very proud that Ania, who was also a student at that time, is now the keynote speaker of this conference. So we are really pleased that we could meet because of the GGP data and because of this, of our engagement and this the previous history of the institute and also of the Warsaw School of Economics. And I remember that time; it was very emotional time for us, 2003, because we were just before the accession to European Union. And I have to say that this time is also very emotional for us from this political point of view, because we are on the eve of the election in October, and we are very concerned about the results of this election. You know about our troubles to cooperate with the European Union, and so on. So this is also an important time for us from the point of view of the general position of universities of Poland in the European Union. So I hope that you understand how pleased we are with this meeting, and I do hope that you will remember in the future this scientific discussion, similar to this remembrance about this 2003 conference. So I wish all of us this fruitful discussion, and I think it's time to invite Anna to present her lecture, The Student 20 Years Ago.
So the floor is yours, Anna. We know each other from the student time, so yeah.
We were both students at that conference. So welcome, everybody. I must say that I feel really honored to speak in this conference and in this building. I'm indeed an alumni of the Warsaw School of Economics, have all my degrees from here, but then life happened as they happened, and I'm now at the University of Warsaw. So I changed a little bit the topic, but basically I will be speaking about the same, what I promised. So technology, labor market change, and fertility. I will speak, so basically the graph which I included into the first slide already kind of suggests what I will be speaking about. So I will be speaking about the changes in the labor market, driven by technology, but also partly by globalization, because globalization certainly contributes and also interacts with this technological change, probably making the changes faster. How these changes affect fertility. And I will focus on two aspects of this labor market change driven by technology. These are automation and also the spread of information and communication technologies, which allowed more flexible working, largely working from home, but basically more flexible working. And a large part of my talk will be actually about the labor market, which is but because I basically want to explain why. Why, to the heaven's sake, do I study how robots affect fertility? Yeah? Because that's very weird, and people always ask, but why, actually? What are you doing? It's kind of nonsense. I want to explain very well what these robots are doing in the labor market and how that all works, and whether jobs are really destroyed or only some of them are destroyed, and whose jobs are destroyed, and whether new jobs are being created, who benefits and who loses, and how that later on may get reflected in our fertility behaviors or fertility behaviors of workers. And that will be the first part of the talk, and then later on I will move to flexibilities and working flexible organization of the working time and work from home. Okay. So, as promised, I will talk a lot about the labor market at the beginning. To explain, so the labor market, here you have the figure, I hope I selected to demonstrate the labor market well. Why is it important? It is important for our functioning for various reasons, which I listed on this slide, right? It can be income, because the labor market and participation in the labor market provides us with income. It gives us independence, financial independence, independence from the state, independence from the partner, for instance. It empowers us because it gives us financial resources. It can provide dignity, it can provide meaning in life, it can allow, maybe not to everybody, but certainly to many persons, some personal growth and some self-accomplishment. It is also a source of social contacts for everybody. So we meet people in the labor market, and that helps us probably in many respects, to live or also to enjoy life. It also has positive, the labor market and the fact that we participate in it has also positive macroeconomic consequences, because by working in the labor market, we contribute to innovation and development, we contribute to economic growth, and the labor market has a very important function also, it redistributes. So, of course, the welfare state redistributes, and that's how we usually tend to think about the redistribution, that the welfare state, so we provide, we earn the income, we pay taxes in the, we earn the income in the labor market, we pay taxes, and then the welfare state redistributes this. But now I would like to, actually, without talking myself, I wanna let you listen to a very short 2 minutes extract from a podcast about capitalism, and the interview is with David Ator, author, a very well-known labor market economist, and actually he explains the distribution very well. And I need it later on, I will refer later on to this quote.
We have an interest in making sure that work works for most people, and the reason is, you know, 60% of GDP goes to labor, and that's our primary means of income distribution. And if we didn't have that system, if money came out of a hole in the ground, right, and then we all had to redistribute it, right, it would be a war of all against all. Or let's say it came out of a hole in one person's lawn, and then we had to tax it and redistribute it, right? It would be a terrible, terrible problem. So we have an interest in making sure that work works for most people.
That's basically what I wanted to hear. Yeah? So if there was no labor market, but that there would be some money to redistribute, how would we do it? Eh? No way. So the labor market actually allows us to redistribute it, and also in a way that we contribute to the common good. The problem is if the labor market doesn't work well, but I will come back to this. So this is once again my presentation, right? So I will talk about the labor market and how the labor market affects fertility. We know from demography that it does, right? Because it defines, allows us to earn income, it defines how much time we can spend for the family and how much time we have to spend in the labor market. It can generate also some incompatibilities. And for all these reasons that I listed before, also that it gives some satisfaction or some frustration, that it can bring some stress, that can also shape our fertility decisions. And this labor market is affected by these two big developments. One is actually automation, driven by technology. One is automation, and the other one is work autonomy. And I focus first on automation. So actually, I cannot talk about this process without mentioning this book, Power and Progress, written by two very also well-known economists, Daron Acemoglu and Simon Johnson. And in this book, I mean, I really recommend you to read it. It's, you read it like a science fiction or like a book you read, you know, in the evening before you fall asleep. No way, no difficult scientific language or anything like that. They basically provide a very nice history of the technological innovations and how they were changing the labor market. And they actually say that, well, technology is great. Technological innovations really contributed to economic growth, but it was not always to the good of everybody. Sometimes it was, but sometimes there were also losers. And there were people who were falling behind when the new technologies were being implemented. And basically they say in the book that these technologies which were being implemented can have labor augmenting or displacing effects. And that all depends on whether the implementation of the machines increases marginal productivity of workers, so whether the productivity increases with every additional worker who is employed at the company. And I will come back to this. And it also depends on the institutions which are implemented or present. And they give several examples, right, when they go through the whole history since the Middle Ages. And I just refer to two and then move back to what is happening in the labor market today. So the first example, a very well-known one, is the electric assembly line, right, which was introduced at the beginning of the previous century which actually was a big success. So it was actually an automation. It was an introduction of the assembly line, which actually workers were also afraid that it may replace them, because it clearly speeded up. So it was taking much longer to produce a car than it started to be when the electric assembly line was introduced. So basically the time for production and the cost of production seriously been lowered, production tripled, also the car prices declined three times. But what happened was that this assembly line actually turned out not to displace workers, not to replace them, but to complement their labor. So they were still needed there. They could be more productive, so exactly the marginal productivity per worker increased, but they were needed. They couldn't just go home, because the assembly line wouldn't function. Then there was something more. So there was this positive effect on the marginal productivity of workers, but there was one more thing. Workers at the beginning didn't like the assembly line. So they started to move to work into the competing companies, because it was the Ford company which introduced this. And then Ford came with a proposal. He reduced the working hours per day from 9 to 8, and he doubled the hourly wages. So these were the institutions, right, which he implemented or he changed. And actually that was then that the production boomed. He didn't seize all the profits that the assembly line would give him. But he said, I want these workers to be well off, so that they can also buy the cars I'm producing. And well, that worked, right? Production tripled, and he became for a long time one of the best. The Ford company has been known very well for producing cars and expanded a lot. Then I go to another example, which seemed to be also labor augmenting because it improved the marginal productivity per worker. But institutions were missing. And this was the invention of the cotton gin. This was actually a little bit earlier than the electric assembly line. So the cotton gin was a machine which strongly speeded up extracting cotton fiber from the seeds. It used to take, I wrote it here, it used to take, per day, without the cotton gin, it was possible to extract 2 to 3 pounds of the cotton fiber from the cotton seeds. When the cotton gin was introduced, this production increased to 50 pounds per day. So that was a huge increase. And in fact, there was a huge expansion of the cotton production. US became a leader in that respect and actually expanded workforce. And I say it on purpose like this, because it was slave workforce, right? So that was the time when the US was importing slaves from Africa to work on the cotton plants. And in fact, the employment expanded from 7,000 to 3 million people working in the field. It just, so positive effect on employment, but simply these people didn't get anything out of that because institutions were missing. So it was the plant owners, capital owners who benefited. And now we move to today's time, when we have the industrial robots implemented in the same car companies which previously used the electric assembly lines, and where we have, for instance, the automatic self-checkouts implemented in supermarkets in many advanced economies. And we may wonder, and many other innovations, and we may wonder, are these labor augmenting or labor displacing? And we don't fully know. So there is a lot of discussion about this in research. But there are hints which allow us to think that actually they may be labor displacing. Let's think about this self-checkout in the supermarkets. Does it imply that people work, are needed, and they can be more productive selling the products in the supermarket? Not really, because they are not needed. Maybe just one or two persons are needed there to help the customers who have some problems with the machines. But apart from this, the people are not needed. The same in the car companies. The workers who used to stand at the assembly line are not needed any longer. So there is some profit. And now the question is, what happens to this profit? The story can go in both directions. It can happen that the profit is used by the capital owners to invest and create other jobs in other places or in other segments of the economy. But it can be the reverse, that they seize the profits and benefit themselves. And then it depends a lot on the institutions we implement, and that's actually what the authors of this book, it's not myself, say, how we shape our economies. Okay, so I move on. So how does it look like? So what do we know from research about how these technologies affect the labor market? And I need this intro to move to fertility, but I will do, I promise. So it seems that there are countries like this, which are mentioned in the bottom, where actually what we observe is a decoupling of the labor productivity from real wages. So the labor productivity, not everywhere, but in the leading companies, the leading technological leaders. This is the black lines. You can see the labor productivity in these companies, and you see the real wages. And what you can see is actually wages are not growing as quickly as the productivity, though they should, right? If the there is more productivity, there is more output, and then this this larger output creates additional labor demand, wages should increase, but they don't. That means that this productivity, that the output which is being produced, is seized by the capital owners and used for something else, not for the expansion of jobs. But this is in these technologically leading companies, not in the remaining ones which are marked in blue, where actually productivity follows, wages follow the productivity. And only in this country. So actually in some other countries, this is the analysis by the OECD, we don't observe this trend. So I'm not saying this happens everywhere, but I was shocked actually that Sweden is on this list. I'm not astonished by the US, right? But I was astonished that, for instance, Sweden or Denmark are on this list. Okay.
What else?
So does this mean that everybody loses, right? All workers due to this technological progress. And actually what's happened, right? So is this that some jobs will simply disappear? Well, so what research is saying that jobs will not disappear completely, they will change. Right, so there are various estimates. Some say that 9 to 14% of jobs are at high risk of full automation, so indeed they will likely disappear. But the further 25 to 30% of jobs will change. So 50 to 70% of tasks people do at these jobs are automatable, so people will have to adjust, maybe reduce their working hours, we don't know. The jobs will not fully disappear. But again, the question is, whose jobs, right? And this figure, I hope, illustrates this nicely. The jobs of the low-skilled, not of the highly skilled. We are not threatened. I'm not afraid of my job. Maybe now with the AI, but I'm optimistic, seeing what I can get out of the ChatGPT. I think it's rather complementary. So we are not losing. But the low-educated persons can lose a lot. It's actually not 9 to 14% of their jobs which are at high risk of automation. It's around 50% of the jobs of the low-educated which are at the high risk of automation. And they have to do something with themselves. Maybe there will be other jobs for them. They have to adjust. So maybe they will be jobless. We don't know. Okay. And one more example from research, and then I move to fertility. It's about actually strictly adoption of industrial robots and employment, how the adoption of industrial robots affects employment, what the research tells us about this. So at the general level, when we take into account effects of the robot adoption on the total employment rate, the effect is very small. There is some small negative effect in the US and zero in Europe. But again, this effect depends on the skills of the workforce, right? So you see people with the master's and doctoral degrees, they are not affected. It is the others who are the less educated ones who are affected. This figure is for the US, but the Gretz and Michaels got a similar finding for Europe.
Okay,
so there is a clear social gradient. Right? Here also a summary. A clear social gradient. The demand for labor changes and it shifts from the low and medium educated to the highly educated, who are actually quite strongly desired in the labor market. We need specialists, we need engineers, we need IT specialists, we need researchers, we need scientists, we need also people, managers, lawyers, right? People also with soft skills, like people who are able to provide high-level care or teachers and educators. Right? So we need this sort of people. But the low-educated, not so much. And what research is basically showing, it's not only that they lose in terms of wages or employment opportunities, but those low-educated or middle-educated people who are exposed to automation, they are also more likely to experience stress, depression, problems with the mental health, uncertainty, and even higher mortality.
And what is also important, and what I also want to stress, is that this change is not cyclical. So it's not like during the Great Depression that there was a slowdown in the economy and some people were losing jobs. But of course, after 5 years, the economy started to boom again and people were able to regain their jobs, this or other, right? That's not the case. This is a permanent change. So it's not like this that now we implement robots, but then we stop doing this. Or, right? That change happens and happens and happens. And this graph shows it for selected countries, right? You can see unemployment is cyclical since the 90s till today, while this is the black curve. While the gray curve shows that the increase in the robot adoption is simply an upward trend. And I'm showing this because people sometimes ask me, oh, but why do you study effects of robotization on fertility? Why don't you study the effect of unemployment? That's the reason, right? Because that's not only about unemployment. The unemployed, okay, they lost the job. But those who have a job in manufacturing, they may even have a permanent job, but they are exposed maybe to some sort of deprivation, maybe to a job loss in the future, maybe to stagnant wages, especially related to other employees in the same company who benefit from this change. Okay, so that's what I studied. How the implementation, how the exposure of people to automation, and indeed I look at industrial robots in the research which I will show you now, but of course, automation is a wider concept, right? So it can be also this self-checking machines in the supermarkets. So how automation, how exposure to all these processes affects fertility. And this is, we conducted together with Linus Andersson from Sweden and Wojciech Harde from my team, a study using the Swedish register data. In fact, to address this problem. And I must say, I didn't expect to find much in Sweden, right? Highly regulated labor market. Okay, but let's try. We tried because at the same time, we needed large data sets. And that was what the Swedish register was able to provide. So we used data since the early 90s, till 2017. And we had the Swedish register data, so we had fertility histories and employment histories. Within the employment histories, we were able to have information also on the occupation and the sector in which one works, very detailed sector, so whether it's a car-producing industry or some other sort of industry or whether it's education. Well, so this is what I mean while talking about the sector. At the three-digit level, so there is this classification of industries, and we were able to went down to the third digit. And we also had data from the International Federation of Robotics on the robot stocks, on the adoption of robots by industry in Sweden since the early 90s till today, so the time, right? So constructed following the literature. We didn't invent this measure. We followed the economic literature and we constructed the measure exposure to robots, which is the number of robots which were implemented in the industry I at time t, divided by employment in this industry at time t0. It was 1993. So at the beginning of the automation, and that's exactly when automation was starting in Sweden. At the beginning, they didn't have much. So this was our measure. We linked it to the employment histories because we had this information on the industry, and we looked how the fact that the worker worked in the industry, which was exposed to the adoption of industrial robots, whether this influenced or was somehow related to his or her family-related behaviors. We implemented standard discrete time event history models, and we were lucky to be able to study marriage, first, second, third birth, and divorce. These are the findings. As I said, I didn't expect much, and not much came out. You see significant results, but when you look more closely, they are all very, the effects are very small. They are significant because we have registered data. But something, I will show you something on the next slide.
but for the moment, just discuss shortly what we see. The direction is consistent with the expectation, just that the effects are small. So for men, the exposure to robotization, negatively related to the risk of marriage, negatively related to the risk of first birth and second birth, nothing for the first birth, positively related to the risk of divorce. Okay, that's what we expected. For women, quite similar. Marriage not significant, and actually only for the second birth, there is something unexpected, positive results, but apart from this, all the rest is consistent with what we see for men. However, as I said, workers are differently exposed to automation depending on the skills they have. So we decided to look by education groups. And here we are. The effects are definitely larger and definitely diverse by educational groups. So the, can you see the colors? On the top, so the navy pink, the blue, the dark pink, is the highly educated, and then the middle educated, and the dark one, navy blue, is the low educated. Yes, the low educated. Yes. And what we can see for men, apart from the first birth, and maybe also let the divorce out for the moment, marriage, first birth, second birth, we can see that the highly educated, if they work in companies where the, or sectors where robots are adopted, they are actually more likely to marry, have the first birth and the second. But not the low educated, so the navy blue, right? For the third birth, we see something else, which I don't fully understand. It seems that actually both highly educated and middle educated are less likely to have the third birth, but that's also a highly selected sample already. Divorce. Here, actually, the effects are the biggest. And we can see that the highly educated and the middle educated, if they work in sectors which are adopting robots, they are far less likely to divorce. I mean, the risks, maybe, because I didn't say how to explain, the risk of divorce within the education declines with the adoption of robots, with the increase of robotization within the sector. That's the correct interpretation. The opposite for the low educated. For women, the story, no, it's not the same. It's a bit different in the same, in the sense that we observe some U-shape. So the marriage, right? The middle educated are negatively affected by automation, not the low educated and the highly educated. First birth, the same. For the second birth, the pattern is more similar as for men. The third, again, a little bit kind of a U-shape. And the divorce, very similar to men. So, indeed, I mean, from this, when we saw it, we thought, wow, so even in Sweden, an increase in automation, an increase in the adoption of robots affects family-related behaviors of workers. And it affects them positively, rather, for the highly educated who benefit from the change, but more negatively for the low and middle skilled. Okay, so that's it. And I will come back to these findings, but now I move to the work autonomy.
How much time do I have?
Fine. Okay. So I move to the other part of the story, which is the increase in work autonomy. And we know that work autonomy has been increasing. That's not only due to technology. Technology, of course, speeded it up. It allowed us, for instance, to work from home, to work more flexibly. But there have been also changes in the organizations, partly probably related to globalization, which let the employers allow workers to work flexibly so that they can actually work more efficiently. So the flexibility, there is lots of literature on this, saying that actually employers want to attract highly educated, well-skilled workers by allowing, granting them flexibility, and we can kind of observe it now, even in the job advertisements directed to highly educated professionals, which allow working from home. So that was one of the motivations. The other one was actually, which is also discussed in the literature, is that actually employers realize that if they allow flexibility, people may actually work more intensely if they allow flexibility and autonomy. People can actually work more intensely and they can feel more responsible for the work outcomes because they have to decide how they work. They don't work since 9 to 5 p.m., but they kind of have to complete the task that they promised they will complete. So, and actually how they organize their time, that is more to them. So this work flexibility, that was the process which was happening already before. It was a little bit related to these changes in the organizations. It was certainly related also to this greater demands and pushing some responsibility on workers for the work outcomes. And of course, the development of the internet, laptops, tablets, computers speeded this whole up. And now, of course, all the Zooms and MS Teams allow us to work remotely or flexibly even more, right? So this is another process which influences the labor market and, of course, affects fertility because it very strongly affects the amount of time and the organization of our time. And that's, of course, important when we think about having children and really taking care. Okay, so just some statistics, yeah, you probably know them. Here I also want to show by education or by some socioeconomic status how the availability of these flexible working hours and telework looks like. The first graph is based on 2019. It shows that the dark bars show that a person can decide with certain restrictions how to organize the working time, and the light bars show that the person can fully decide how to organize the working time, which is, of course, less common. There is some socioeconomic gradient, so highly educated people can do it more. They have more freedom. When we take the two flexibilities together, it's around 60% of the highly educated who have this opportunity versus around 40% of the low educated. So there is a socioeconomic gradient, but it's not so strong when we talk about it is not as strong as when we talk about the telework, right? This graph comes from the pandemic time, so of course it might be exaggerated, but on the other hand, it shows very well what is possible. And here we can see that managers, professionals, also technicians, they can work from home, many of them, but the low-skilled, not really. Some of them do, so there are some small proportions. So I'm not saying that nobody can, and there is also some literature showing that this teleworking among the lower-educated and lower-skilled workers is very often related to precarity. So perhaps they work from home because they have no office, or they work in the gig economy with the computer, right? They are very flexible. but these are precarious jobs. But there is also not much on this because the phenomena is very rare. Anyway, very clear socioeconomic gradient. Okay, so I move to this work autonomy, the when and where. So the flexible organization of working time and the telework, how they, what they mean for us, what they mean for people, and actually how they may be related to our fertility decisions, and I will also show you some findings from our research. So the pros, the advantages of this flexibilities. Well, so they have lots of advantages, and we all know very well about this because we use this flexibility a lot. One of the biggest ones is the possibility to adjust paid work to family demands. So if you are flexible, you can really go to events at the kindergarten and then do the work at home in the evening or at night. You can also cook the dinner if you are working from home, or at least some people think so. because I can't eat, I can't focus on work. And so that you can pick up the children earlier from school, or you can also allow some plumber to come to homes, which is also a home duty, to fix the stuff while you are working. So clearly pro. They also allow time savings, that's for sure, because we don't have to commute when we have to, when we can work from home. And there is one of the like biggest reasons why people say they want to work from home. They don't want to commute. They allow some cost savings, savings on clothes and, for instance, on lunches. Probably we spend more on the electricity and water. Either we don't notice it or these are smaller expenses, but that's also what people say, that there are big cost savings. And we can be more present in children's life, and that's what also the literature say. Even if the child is taken care by another parent or by the babysitter at home, we kind of know better what is happening to the child and how the child is, so we can be more present. So these are the pros, but there are also cons. So one of the cons, which is very often mentioned, is a spillover, right? Spillover from family to work. So when this plumber is coming, of course, it's a spillover, right? It interrupts our work. Or when we cook the dinner, we have to make a break and we have to go there and check whether there is no fire in the oven and so on. So that also distracts us for work. That leads very much, and the time use surveys show it, to fragmented working time and multitasking, which can be also stressful. And that's very often what women do. There is a very nice study for Australia, which actually showed that men who work from home, they just work from home. They don't have the fragmented working time, and they don't multitask. While women actually, yeah, they let the plumber in, and they cook the dinner in the meantime, and then they also open the door during the Zoom call to serve the children's needs, and they do all this stuff. And then they end up working late in the evening also to finish the work that they didn't manage. So that's the fragmented working time. That's very also strongly related to the higher expectations regarding housework and childcare. Because if you are flexible, then you can stay at home and let the plumber in, right? And you can go to the kindergarten even, because you can. I can't, because I have to be at work till 5. And the another disadvantage of this flexibility is higher work intensity, and that's basically what I was already talking about, right? So it is kind of designed in a way that we are more... first, we cannot disconnect from work once we have it at home, if it's teleworking. Then second, employers may expect, and research really shows it, that people will work longer if they work from home in exchange, right? Because they are grateful for this flexibility which they were granted. There is, for instance, research in India showing that actually employees who were sent from the call center, who were sent home to work, they worked longer. They didn't make breaks. And that was actually what the employer liked, how it was designed, because the idea was that actually the flexibility was granted for in exchange for this larger work intensity, larger work effort. We can also work longer. I mean, that's what we academics all do, but that's also what many professionals do, that since there is no clear boundary, right, we are at home, or we can arrange flexibly, so maybe we work a little bit over the weekend or in the evening or at night, or we go to the office for a while to do it flexibly. So maybe I will do this additional thing, I will manage, right? So there are no clear time boundaries, so we actually can work longer. It's of course up to us how we organize it, and that's probably very much culture dependent. So there are countries where the culture is in a way that, no, you should finish and it's fine what you did. But countries like US, UK, Korea, and I think Poland also belongs to these countries, where actually we kind of pursue this ideal worker model of a worker who should work a lot and who should complete all these tasks, and actually we use the flexibility to work longer. Okay, and the last point, the stress I already mentioned, the last point is the flexibility, stigma, and negative career consequences. So workers who ask for flexibility, and there is also lots of experimental studies on this, they are punished. They are punished, especially if they have children, because the employer knows that these workers are not well committed. The employer can be also afraid that these workers will not be productive at home. Maybe now less than in the past, but certainly the employers think that those employees who ask for working from home, they are not that committed to work. They are not ideal workers who can spend lots of face time at work because they have children, they have other, they dare to have other obligations. That's why they will not be promoted. And I can mention that actually in my team we conducted a study in UK in the post-pandemic context in the second half of 2022, experimental study where we sent vignettes to employers and we ask them, oh, how do you evaluate this and this worker? And of course, we manipulated with whether the worker works from home or not. And even in the UK, where the flexible telework is quite widespread, even in the post-pandemic context, employers were less likely to grant promotion and salary increase to those who work from home, especially if they had childcare obligations. Okay, so there are these pros and cons, right? There are these pros and cons. Okay. There are these pros and cons. Of course, they may work also differently for people from different socioeconomic strata. Eh? So, for instance, these expectations regarding childless housework and childcare. Highly educated women may protect themselves better than the low educated women from this. They may also outsource, they have resources to outsource the housework, for instance, cleaning better. Than the low-educated women. They can bargain better with their partners, who tend to be usually more egalitarian and who tend to share the housework and childcare duties more equally with them than the low-educated. They can be also have better bargaining power with the employer, right? So they may not allow them, the employer, to exploit them. To expect that they will work longer because they ask for the flexibility. Perhaps they have the skills the employer needs and they know that they can bargain and they can actually work as much as they can, but not longer. Right? So there might be also some socioeconomic difference, but I don't want to talk too long on this. I move to how this flexibility of the possibility to organize working time and working from home can affect having children. And this is the second study from our team, which I want to, from which I want to show you some results, conducted to, together with Beata Osiewalska on the data from the UK. The Understanding Societies 2009-2019. We focused on partnered women aged 18 to 44, childless, as well as women with one child. So we looked at the transition to the first child and the transition to the second child. And we also looked at their partners, right? So basically we focused on couples. We used discrete time event history models, and we used the UK data actually for one major reason. It's because it provided information on these two flexibilities. So one was based on the question, do you have a control over the start and end of the working day? So basically the working time flexibility. And the other question was about working from home. Now, there was two questions. Now, I try to think whether I remember how they were asked. Do you have the possibility to work from home regularly, irregularly? And if you have this possibility, do you use it? Something like this. And based on these questions, we constructed our measure of the possibility of the regular or irregular use of this of telework. The data, so we stopped before the COVID, simply because we didn't want to have all this turmoil related to the COVID time. In our data, UK was one of the countries where working from home was quite widespread, similarly widespread as in the Nordic countries. So actually, it was possible to do something with it. We had lots of controls, women's age, ethnicity, health, family orientation, partnership status, men's and women's education, income, calendar time, and the childcare use for parents. And I move to results. So these are first the results on the transition to the first and second birth for the and they show how the predicted probabilities for people with low, medium, and high flexibility of the working time. So we divided these people in three groups, and also self-employed and not working for companies. What we can see that actually the flexibility is not positively related to the transition to the first birth, and we were pretty astonished by this finding. We control for education, but, well, we thought it's probably because these people who have this flexibility, they have jobs, they have very good jobs, and they may actually postpone the transition to motherhood. These are women, so this is the flexibility for the woman, the possibility to organize working time flexibly by a woman. So this woman may postpone the transition to motherhood because they are in good jobs, which allow them flexible working, but they also give them something else, which we are not capturing. But as you can see, once they have a child, the first child, there seems to be some positive, though not significant, trend towards the second for those who have more flexibility. And then we disaggregated by education. And here are the findings. For the first birth, not much. So both the lower educated and the highly educated, we see this negative trend, though here not any longer significant, but don't worry. The more flexibility there is, the more they are likely to postpone. But for the second birth, we see a positive relationship. But only for the highly educated, tertiary educated, not for the others. So they have the flexibility in their jobs, which allows them or is positively related with the transition to the second child. They can afford it. But for the low educated, for some reasons, this flexibility doesn't help. Well, I can't fully explain why, but there are some other factors in their jobs, perhaps which we are not able to control, or perhaps this flexibility is related to some precarity that, well, doesn't increase the transition to the second birth. Now, telework. Very similar pattern. When you look at the first birth and second birth probabilities, we don't differentiate by education, we see a similar pattern. So negative gradients. Well, I'm not sure this is the right figure. I think it's not, because it's exactly the same, right? Okay, then you have to believe me. The pattern was very similar. Even though I pasted the flexibility, working time flexibility figures here, but actually if I pasted the working from home, it would be also negative relationship. I don't remember whether significant, and positive relationship for the second birth. I don't remember whether significant, but it's going this direction. Fortunately here, and this is more important, I have correct graphs. So on-site, irregular, regular working from home, right? And here we can see for the low educated, so this darker, below tertiary, not low educated, below tertiary, we see a clearly negative pattern. So those who can work from home irregularly or regularly and are working and are low educated or not tertiary educated, less likely to have the first child. We don't see this for the highly educated. And we see a positive gradient, maybe not significant, okay, but for the tertiary educated when it comes to the second birth, and clearly negative when it comes for the low educated, right? So those low educated who work from home, they are less likely to have the second child, while for the highly educated, something positive emerges, but not significant. We also don't have many of these teleworking persons in the sample. So clearly, the flexibility, very similarly as the possibility to organize working time, the possibility to work from home, works differently for the highly educated than for the low educated. Okay, so summing up this whole story about automation and flexibility in the labor market and how they affect fertility. So we know from previous research that actually there is clear socioeconomic gradient. Less skilled workers increasingly struggle in the labor market. They are more negatively exposed to negative consequences of automation and have less access to this work autonomy. And it seems that this struggle from our research just for two countries, and we are working hard on repeating the studies for other countries. We are a bit constrained by the data, but I will come back to this at the end of the presentation. These struggles constrained their family formation. So somehow it looks the redistributive function of the labor market starts to fail, and it does not only affect the earning opportunities of the various socioeconomic groups in the labor market, but it does affect also other spheres of their lives, and what I've showed does affect their fertility, family formation. So what these people can do? I was wondering whether I should continue talking about this, but I just thought, why not making a broader story? What they can do? Well, they can protest, right? Sometimes they do in France. They can, we had this protest of the yellow jackets. It was exactly about this, about hiring taxes, which actually hit the lower socioeconomic strata in the society. They can also vote, and they do. And this is the research showing, because I'm not the only one who looks into the robots and automation, right? So this is the research, which shows that actually people who are exposed to robotization, but also international trade, so they are being at the risk of being dismissed from work because of the globalization, that these people tend to turn to vote for the far right or populist parties. There is such a study conducted in Italy, US, and the last one which I'm showing, Western Europe. There are more. They are very consistent. There is a trend that these people who are left behind, they tend to vote for the far right. Well, that's I think I leave you with this, what we can do. I think that's very fortunate, actually, that they can vote. It's just that it tends against those who benefit from the change which is happening in the labor market. Okay, so I conclude, and I want to conclude referring to the data, and also because this is the GGS user conference. I show that economic activity matters for family formation. We know it from lots of past research of many demographers. But what I want to say is that labor market has undergone huge changes, which go beyond having a job or not, which go beyond working part-time versus full-time, or beyond working on a permanent or temporary contract. These are various types of flexibilities, which can be how we organize our working time, when we work, or where we work, but also whether this flexibility is really oriented toward the employees, or actually it's oriented toward the needs of the employers. And we are also conducting a study on this to look actually, we are trying to measure this and look how this affects fertility behaviors of people. Work intensity has changed and we are not fully capturing it. It seems we are working fewer hours, but there is lots of research showing that at least in some countries, people work very intense, especially in some professions. So the professionals and the managers, they work very intensely. They have lots of flexibility, but they also work quite intensely. There is lots of changes in the demands for skills, right? So that's what I was talking about, which caused necessity to reskill, upskill, and adapt. And also the quality of jobs has been changing tremendously. For some people, maybe it's improving. I would again say that this is for the highly skilled, but for the low skilled who get exposed to these changes, who get dismissed from the labor market, it gets worse and worse. And the problem is that the social surveys lack data which would allow to measure all these concepts. So actually, the fact, I'm really unhappy that I was able to show you findings only from two countries. I would really love to compare how the working from home is related to fertility across various European countries. But it's not so easy. In the GSOEP, I thought, we just use the GSOEP. Well, it's available, I don't know, since 2009, every second year or every fifth year, right? It's not so easy. So actually, that's the challenge. And I think In the GTS, it's also a challenge, which is also why I'm not using it, especially that I'm very strongly attached to the longitudinal data, not the cross-sectional. But I think that's something, I don't know whether I convinced you or not, but it would be that's something that we really, as social scientists, have to change, not necessarily in the GTS, because it's not possible to pack everything to this already huge questionnaire, but in general. What we are trying to do at LabFAM, we are actually harmonizing data from, but it's again, from these available panels, which we all use from the US and Australia and UK and Germany and Switzerland. And what else we have? So we try to also do something for Italy. We are harmonizing them so that it would be easy to study interdependencies between partnership, fertility, and employment careers. And we organize these files in the form of the spell event data, exactly how the demographers like it and use it. So that will be an open source data. But I'm showing this not to advertise it, but actually if you know of the data which actually we could add, which would include some fertility partnership, but also more detailed employment histories, not only whether one has a job or not, but for instance occupation, which already provides lots of information, because we can kind of say, okay, these occupations are teleworkable or not, these people get exposed to automation, and in this they are less exposed to automation, that already says something. So we would be happy to incorporate this data into this database. So thank you very much once again. I should say that lots of this research which I presented here was conducted within the my ERC project, Technology and Globalization Driven Labor Market Change, LabFAM, and I'm really grateful to the EU for the opportunity to do it. LabFAM is conducted at the center, LabFAM, which already was mentioned here, which I established at the University of Warsaw. It causes some confusion, LabFAM, so for clarification. Okay, so thank you very much for listening to me, and I'm really looking forward to your comments, suggestions, and answering your questions. Thank you.
Anna, thank you very much for lots of food for thoughts for all of us, and now we have time for questions or comments from you. And after this, we have a small break before the next session.
I'll break the ice. Thank you so much, Anna, for this fascinating story you took us through. What I was thinking is that obviously our world and the world of the labor market has changed since the pandemic. What the pandemic has done when it comes to flexibility of working is that thing to some extent has convinced employers that it is possible to work at home, that people, some of the stereotypes or perception you were referring to, that, oh, I'm sure surely employees are not very productive when they're at home. To some extent, I think it has shown that it can work to some extent, and maybe also we've become better at working from home than we were at the beginning. So I'm just curious to know from your thought on if you had data just before the pandemic and just after the pandemic and looking at the impact of work flexibility, either working from home or choosing your own hours of work, do you think you would still find the same results, or as the pandemic, as I claim here, has changed so much our work of world, our world of work?
You can respond to that one.
So yeah, pandemic for sure changed a lot, though I think not fully, because as I said, we conducted this experiment in the UK post-pandemic, and still people get punished. Unfortunately, I don't know, we don't have similar data before the pandemic, right? There are other experiments like this, but of course not comparable fully to ours. How it affects fertility, so we don't have the data, waiting for them, I think all of us. I think it will be, more people will work from home and actually employers will be more positive, but still it seems this negative stereotypes didn't vanish. What I showed in my presentation, I think, was that actually teleworking helps the highly educated to have the second child, and I think it will continue like this after the pandemic, but since more people will have access to this work, then actually it will be easier to have the second child for a larger proportion of people, and I think this might be a positive thing.
Thank you for your talk. I do want to advocate the use of the GDP data once we have countries with a second wave in round two, because then I think you can perfectly study some of these questions with the data. We don't have maybe all aspects of labor that you're looking into, but many of them. So quite soon, I think you will be able to do this with a few countries from GDP.
Oh, great. Happy to hear. I'm actually was thinking that once the second round is available, which will be also post-pandemic, that could be done.
Thank you very much. I really followed your presentation thoroughly. I enjoyed it a lot. My feeling is a lot of this comes from people's lives, right? And probably it was highly inspired by experiences that so many of us of you in that regard in terms of education had. My question here is, how does that feed in back to policymakers, NGOs, and other stakeholders, essentially those who make decisions or could make decisions, for those individuals who experience your found outcomes?
I think it's... I try to convey this message that actually institutions matter a lot, right? And I think these are not only family policies, which we usually discuss, but also such policies like how we tax labor and how we tax capital, and maybe we should tax capital more than labor, because from this it appears that actually so far we tax capital less than labor, right? So that's why actually companies started to invent ways of automating and replacing labor, because it's expensive, right? So this is, for instance, one of the solutions that could be implemented. Other solutions like labor market policies, the policies which try to help people to enter the labor markets as some sort of training of people or also minimum wages, which are there in Europe much more than in the US. And in fact, Europe is faring better in terms of many indicators than US in the areas which I was talking about, which allow the lower educated people be employed and have decent wage, not being low-wage earners, which actually cannot afford having children because they just earn so little. So I think lots of labor market policies are needed and taxation policies are needed. We really should rethink what we want to support, whether we want to support capital flows or we want to actually support labor. I am definitely for labor, but also I can imagine perhaps there are reasons why we should, it's not easy, and why we should also give some favor to capital. We should design policies towards workers, especially those who are struggling, the lower educated, and then the family policies come on the top, right? So these are like different layers of policies which we need.
I actually have two questions. One is a clarification about your event history models. One of the consistent results in your all of your graphs was the difference between the first child and the second child. So I was just wondering whether these were within person comparisons or was it between persons, between children? And the second question is more conceptual about exposure to automation. I'm interested in hearing a more general idea about how people experience automation, where, in what contexts, and how could we possibly obtain better measurements of exposure. You use sectors of the economy, and of course, you know, if you ask workers, they will not, I assume, speak that much about a particular sector of the economy, but about their particular workplace, the workshop, or the firm where they work. So, you know, you ended your talk with reference to the need and demand for better data. So, in that sense, I would like you to elaborate more on what we could do to obtain better measures of exposure to automation, exposure to robots, that would go beyond the simple distinction of sectors within the economy.
So maybe I start with the second one. I think employer-employee linked data. I don't think asking people how much we can get from asking people, because they may not know it, or we will get some subjective views, which can be also important, because that's if they feel somehow that will also affect their family-related decisions. But if we would like something objective, then employee-employer linked data. So we have the histories about the employees, how much they earn, and whether they have children, and so on, linked to the employer-related the data at the company level. We are trying to work with the Norwegian registers, with our colleagues there, actually to do something like this. So I think that would be the best way. The best path to go. Within person, between person. So it's like standard event history models. So, of course, we mix a little bit the between person variation as well, which, of course, can cause some bias. In the first models on automation, we are experimenting with some instrumental variables, which should take this bias away. And for the moment, what we see, these instrumental variables are not changing the findings, but these models are not yet final. That's a mix of both variations, and of course, that's why we should rather talk about correlations and net effects. But I think that's the problem we basically all have as demographers.
We know that it's not only the education, but the occupation where people are working. So could you conduct some further analysis on impact of sectors or occupations on first and second births?
Yes, so we tried with the Swedish data. We also used the information, we conducted also, did the analysis by occupational group. The findings were pretty similar, but the period of observation was shorter since the data on occupations was available since 2001, not since the beginning of the 90s. But basically the findings were consistent. I was actually thinking to include them, but I thought that will repeat a little bit the story. I agree, occupation is very, very much important here.
We want to have a small break before the next session. I think we can finish now and move the potential discussion to this room in the neighborhood.
What I also want to say is that because we know that in the current times the internet is as important as coffee, our IT team has generated the passwords for you, so please ask the organizers about the passwords, and you can have internet access via our Wi-Fi. Yeah. So, have a break.
Wojtku, czy teraz nas słychać? A teraz musisz się odmutować. Odmutuj się, zobaczymy, czy ciebie słychać.
A czy tego nie zmutowałaś? A nie.
A poczekaj, bo my ciebie nie słyszymy. Moment.
Wejdź na...
Can you try to say something now? No, hold on, we are trying to. And once again?
1, 1, 1, 1, 2, 3.
Okay, okay, great.
Can you try to share your slides now? Because at the moment you are at the moment being seen through the by the whole room.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I can see it. Okay, I will share the presentation.
Okay.
It's still in the program, so not the presenter view, but we can see the presentation.
And now?
No. Something's not working the way it's supposed to. Pracujesz na...
Now it's in the presenter mode. Now it's in the presenter mode. Yeah.
Masz na dwóch ekranach?
Nie, mam na jednym.
No to nie wiem.
Spróbuj udostępnić przez nie ekran, tylko przez okno. Bo pokaz slajdu wybierasz jako osobne okno. Więc po prostu
a jako, udostępniasz nie jako ekran, tylko jako okno. Tutaj Marta podpowiada.
W drugą stronę.
Albo...
Okay. Jeżeli mogę, to spróbuj odpalić prezentację. Po prostu tak, który prezentera tak? Pokaz slajdów. Mhm. I zrobić alt-tabem przerzucić na Teamsy.
Teraz?
I teraz kliknąć udostępnij i poszukać opcji okno, pokaz slajdów PowerPointa.
No, chyba mi się to nie udaje zrobić, ale zawsze jest taka opcja, że po prostu wy tę prezentację odpalicie, a ja będę. Może tak będzie łatwiej.
I will be your slide changer.
Yeah. Good?
Okay, ale oni tak.
Wojtek, I will be, ja będę dzieliła twój ekran, tylko będziesz musiał mi mówić, kiedy slajd zmienić.
Dobra, tak, nie ma problemu.
Dobra, jesteś trzecim prezenterem, także i tak na razie spokojnie się zmutuj i czekaj grzecznie.
Dobra, dzięki.
Tak. Ale mi się czuję. Wojtek jest going to be online. Hold on. What's here? PowerPoint. Okay.
This is the first one from
Adriana. Adriana is the first one. I put Wojtek here. Be careful, be very careful with the mouse, because if you move it aside, it disappears. There.
Okay,
so you need to make sure that it does not disappear.
Okay.
We will try to, yeah.
Okay. Okay, I think we are ready to start now. Okay, so first of all, welcome everyone also from my side. My name is Almut Schumann and I am part of the GGP Central Hub team and I am working at the BIB in Wiesbaden in Germany. So I'm very happy that I can share not only the first session of the GGP User Conference but also the session on survey methods, which is, I think, a very exciting and interesting topic and also a very important topic, especially in times when data collection changes increasingly and also impacts data infrastructures such as the GGP. And therefore, we will have a flash session today on this topic. We will have a series of six presentations and we have 1 hour time and every presenter has a maximum of 7 minutes. And because we have so many presentations and only less time, we will first hear all presentations in a row, and afterwards we will have a joint discussion and use the remaining time for
talking together. That means if you have any questions or comments that come up in your mind, please keep them in your mind or write them down so that we can address them at the end of our presentation. Yeah, and therefore I would now say we will start with the first presentation, which will be held by Arianna Corporali. And this is about the DGP data and metadata portal. So Arianna, the floor is yours.
Hello, everybody. So we'll be presenting our work done together with Meredith Wynne Lombard and Julie Noir at TNET. So data documentation is necessary for data archiving and to comply with the FAIR principles, which are very important in the context of open data. Most of the data archives today use the Data Documentation Initiative, DDI standards, and in GGS we have been using these standards since the first round, but our data documentation procedure was only partially automated, and we used a software called Nessa, which was discontinued, and here you have the picture of our old data platform. So today I will present some innovations that we introduced with the second round of GGS, so the new data documentation procedure, the new DGP data and metadata portal, and some ongoing work. With the start of the second round, we chose Collectica as a software because Collectica is compatible with BLES software, which is used by most countries fielding DGP. So meaning that it is possible to import in Collectica BLES output files and document the variables automatically in DDI. Collectica is compliant with the specification of DDI called lifecycle, which is specifically suited for longitudinal surveys, and it is used by other longitudinal surveys. Concerning the data documentation procedure, so the variable level documentation, we work in close collaboration with the data processing team at NIDI. We receive from them data sets in SCADA, the core questionnaire, and the national questionnaires in place format, and details on country-specific variables, which are provided by the national teams. Without entering too much into the details, we process all these files in Stata, R, Collectica, and Excel, and we create the so-called metadata input sheet, which looks like this, and we apply this file in the Stata, to the Stata datasets in Collectica to document the variables and produce a codebook compliant with DDI. So the columns about the variable names, labels, types, codes, and missing value codes are extracted from the dataset. The question text and the topics are extracted from the core questionnaire. For the country-specific variables, we copy the information from the file provided by the national teams. We also document the filters, so the conditions, which are extracted from the national questionnaire in BLES. And the column description contains details on country deviations and generated variables. And this column is created partly through Excel formula to extract flagged country specificities. So throughout this process, we merge and compare information from different files, and we run quality checks. The first concerns inconsistencies between the core questionnaire, the national questionnaire, and the country data file. For example, we detect unreported country-specific variables. The second concerns inconsistencies between country-specific questions and the corresponding response categories. For example, there may be issues in the translation of the original questionnaire. And the third, quality check concerns inconsistencies between the country dataset and the dataset used by the GGS team to process the data. For example, we may detect unflagged country specificities, and we report these issues to the team at NIDI. Next to the variables, we also document the service in general. We take this information from the national teams. We collect this information using an Excel file compliant with the DDI standards that you can see in the slide. And this information concerns sampling procedure, mode of data collection, and other information such as data processing and weights. So all this in metadata is then put in Collectica Designer, which looks like this. And this software allows to edit the metadata in DDI format. Then we publish all this information in the GGP Collectica portal, which looks like this is the homepage. Here you can browse the data sets from the new round, but also from the old round. This is a view of survey metadata in Collectica about Norway, second round. So this information is about data collection, and you can browse this online or extract and download files, like for example in PDF, and also additional files such as the questionnaire and methodology reports. Here you have a variable view in Collectica, so you can have metadata about the conditions, the filters, and the description of country-specific deviations, and also the frequency table. So to conclude, compared to DGS, to the first round, the new procedure is faster, there is greater automation, and increased accuracy. In the future, we would like to exploit all the potentiality of DDI lifecycle. In particular, we'd like to implement conceptual variables to compare data sets across ways. And there is ongoing work to increase fairness in the framework of European funded projects, such as GGP 5Bs. And this includes applying permanent identifiers and making our metadata compliant with the CESDA metadata model. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Arianna. We will now directly have the next presentation, which will be by Arike Reikin together. She will present joint work together with two other colleagues from the DGP team about the device use in the DGS2 round.
Okay, good afternoon. So my name is Arike Reike. I work in Central Hub at NIDI. This is joint work with Sian Kong, who's not here today, and with Xiao Su, who is somewhere there in the back. So I'm going to talk to you about device use in our web surveys in the round two of the DGS. So nowadays, web surveys are mixed device surveys. Respondents can choose which device they want to use, which has advantages, but we were wondering whether this also has disadvantages. Maybe, especially, we were worried that maybe phones could be problematic. So throughout the presentation, we focus on three types. All devices are kind of categorized as three types. Big screens, so we combine PCs and laptops. Tablets and phones, but in the interest of time, and because it's a very small group that uses tablets, I won't say much about that. So you see here, I focus on these six countries. Four of these had a web-only survey, and Czech Republic and Uruguay had a mixed mode. They also offered CAPI, but here we focus on web. And you see that very few people chose to use a tablet in their web survey. The countries are ordered by a percentage of those who use a PC or a laptop. So this ranges a lot, as you can see, from 3/4 in the Czech Republic to just over 1/4 in Uruguay and Norway. So, most of the others use the phone. So from 23% in Czech Republic to about 70% in Uruguay and Norway. These percentages are based on The first device people use, so the one they log in with, you might wonder, do they stick to that device or that device type? So here you see the percentages that switch between types. So if they switch from one laptop to the other, we don't count it as a switch, but if they switch from a laptop to a phone, for example, then we count it as a switch. As you can see, it's not that many people do it, although in Uruguay and Norway, where so many people start on a phone, the percentages are a bit high. The samples here are those who completed the full questionnaire. Then we looked into predictors of smartphone use versus laptop. So here we ignore the tablet users. So based on logistic regression models, well, we looked at the predictors. So who do you think are more likely to fill out the questionnaire on a smartphone, women or men? Who thinks women? Well, those two are right. It's indeed in all countries a significant difference between men and women. A poorer or richer people, who thinks the richer people? You're wrong. So it's in all countries. So I use this subjective variable, this item on how difficult it is to make ends meet. And in all countries, the more difficult it is, the more likely you are to use a phone. Because maybe richer people are more likely to have a laptop or even a personal laptop or PC at home. The same goes for education. So it's the lower educated, actually, in all countries except Finland, who are more likely to do a survey on their phone. Younger people, this is not a surprise. This was the case in all countries except Uruguay, but in Uruguay the sample was a bit smaller because most people did CAPI. And the same goes for people with a partner. Here I don't really have an explanation. Maybe again because you want to do it in a private way, but you'd rather do it on your phone if you maybe share your laptop with your partner, I don't know. And then I also looked at whether you're an immigrant, first generation immigrant, or whether you're employed. But between the six countries that we looked at, there are different effects, on there are opposite effects in the different countries. Then what we looked at was the duration of completed interviews by device. We were worried a bit that maybe respondents who do this on a phone are more distracted, so they might take much longer. This is also what the literature says. It could be that people who do surveys on phones take longer, well, either because of the distraction both by the phone or by, because you might be, well, not at home or anything, but also because they might have to scroll more. But in our survey, we usually only have one question per page, so the scrolling should not be a big problem. Well, in the first row, I show the median duration over all devices. You see quite some variation between the countries, from 46 minutes in Norway and Finland. In Austria, they're a bit shorter, and in Czechia, Uruguay, the service took a bit longer. But these countries also have more country-specific added questions. And as we can see here, in three out of the six countries, Austria, Czechia, and Finland, there was actually no significant difference. Oh, not, sorry. Czechia, Finland, and Norway. There was no difference in interview duration between PC or laptop users and phone users. In Austria, the phone users were a bit quicker, so the PC or laptop users were 1 minute, 1 minute longer. In Estonia, the laptop users were a bit quicker. In Uruguay, the difference was a bit bigger. But overall, I would say it's, well, we don't really find strong evidence that it takes longer on the phone, so we thought that's good news. These models are controlling not just for all the variables that I just showed that predict device use, but they also control for the number of questions that the respondent actually got, because you all know that there's a lot of routing and loops, etc. in the questionnaire, so the number of questions that you get also varies a lot, but we control for that. And then finally, we looked at one aspect of data quality. So the predicted probability of survey completion by device, and here I also compare only laptop slash PC versus smartphone. I ordered the countries from the biggest difference to the smallest difference. So you see the samples are people who finish the first few questions of the questionnaire, because we control for sex, age, whether you are born in the country or abroad, and educational level, and these questions are asked, let's say, the first five questions of the questionnaire. So there is already a selection of people who didn't stop before the fifth question. But then you do see a difference. These differences are significant in each country. In Estonia and Norway, it's about 12 percentage points lower, the completion rate by phones, the orange bars. And in Czechia, the difference is only 3 percentage points. So here, you could say, especially in Estonia and Norway, maybe it's a bit more problematic. In these countries, people were invited digitally, so they just had to click a link to start the survey. So it was also very easy to start the survey on your phone, maybe while you're on the bus or whatever, and therefore maybe they broke off. But all in all, we don't have indications yet that filling out the survey on a smartphone is really problematic. A good thing is that the lower educated, the poorer people, the younger people, they're more likely to do it on a phone. So if you offer the possibility to do it by phone, it makes it maybe easier or at least less hard to reach those hard to get groups. But in terms of data quality, so far we only looked, of course, at the breakoff rate, and future plans are to look at other indicators of data quality. For example, if people on phones, they might be more likely to, I don't know, say don't know because they're a bit distracted. These kind of things we want to look into. And that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, we now come to our colleague Wojciech Jablonski, who will join us online. Yeah, he will present us joint work together with a colleague from Uruguay, Ignacio Pardo, and will show us their experience in conducting GGS in Latin America. So, Wojciech, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, we can hear you. Can you hear me? So the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. So welcome everyone. My name is Wojtek Jabłoński. I am part of the GGP team, GGP Central Hub team. And my short presentation today, prepared together with Ignacio Pardo, is about fielding GGS in Uruguay. Next slide, please. In the second round of GGP, we introduced online data collection in most participating countries, and we reduced the face-to-face component. In Latin America, however, this switch into CAVI mode did not occur, mainly because of strong traditions of personal interviews in that region. Next slide, please. In Uruguay, we managed to add a CAVI component to face-to-face data collection, which allow us to compare the data from both groups, face-to-face respondents and CAVI respondents. So now I will present most interesting outcomes from both groups, comparing the data from both CAVI and CAPI. And I will share some qualitative insights based on the interviewer's experience. Next slide, please. So the GGS in Uruguay was fielded in 2021 and 2022 on a household sample, and within household last birthday method was used. We implemented face-to-face recruitment, and then once the participation of the respondent was secured, 80% of the sample was conducted in CAPI mode, so computer-assisted personal interview, and 15% was asked to complete the interview online. Yes, so let's look at... Yeah, next slide, please. Let's look at the response rate by survey mode. As you can see, in CAPI, it is higher than in CAWI. However, 33% for CAWI is not that bad. Next slide, please. If we look at the survey mode by gender, almost no differences can be found. And next slide. And survey mode by age, here we can see that younger respondents were more willing to participate in CAWI questionnaire than older respondents, which is quite understandable. Next slide, please. Now, let's focus on the interviewers. There were 280 interviewers trained, and 205 did at least one interview. We invited those interviewers to complete a short online questionnaire in June this year and share their experiences with us. 69 interviewers completed this interview, so we managed to achieve 34 response rate. We were interested what was more challenging for the interviewers, asking respondents to fill in an online questionnaire or asking them to participate in a face-to-face interview. As you can see, asking to fill in an online questionnaire was more challenging to them. And based on the answer to open-ended question, we know that it was caused by the age of the respondents. So the older respondents were hard to be convinced to participate in an online questionnaire. Next slide, please. We also asked interviewers how often they had the impression that respondents who refused to one mode would agree to participate in another mode. And as you can see, these results are pretty much the same for both configurations. And again, age is an important factor here. When there were older respondents, many interviewers said that those who refused to online would agree to face-to-face, and for younger respondents, those who refused to face-to-face would agree to online. Next slide, please. So in conclusion, you can say that response rate in CAPI mode is higher than in CAWI mode. However, we have to bear in mind that here the recruitment for both modes was face-to-face, unlike in other survey research. All the respondents are more willing to take part in a face-to-face interview than in online survey. We have no indication that online mode does not work in Latin America. And like in other settings, respondents' experience is related to age. Next slide, please. Thank you very much and have a nice evening.
Yeah, thank you very much, Wojciech. We will now come directly to the next presentation that will be by Brianna Pirelli-Harris, who will give us some insights in using a push-to-web approach in conducting the GGS in the UK. So, so we have a short technical problem, but we can solve it, I think. Okay. So, Brienne, the floor is yours.
Hi, everyone. First, I would like to point out that this is work by Grace Chang, Olga Maslovskaya, and then the third author. So, I hope I can answer your questions. So, in this presentation, I'll talk about the representativeness of a UK push-to-web GGS. So the motivation for this paper in particular is to specifically look at what happens when you don't have a sampling framework, a registration, and you need to use this push-to-web approach and then move everybody onto online surveys. So some of the reasons why it's important to start thinking much more about whether or not online surveys are representative is because we have declining response rates in offline surveys. There have been many people who are trying to use online surveys. This is a particular innovation since the pandemic. And in the UK in particular, there's been a difficulty in recruiting interviewers. So some of our face-to-face surveys have been suffering from a lack of interviewers who want to go and knock on people's doors. So we don't know whether or not these online surveys are representative of the population of interest. And as I mentioned, there's an absence of an individual sampling framework. So what we have to use is a push-to-web approach based on a postcode address file. But this is a bit challenging as online response rates are usually relatively low. So the survey agency that we worked with, NatSend, had conducted some online surveys, particularly during the pandemic, and they were able to predict our response rate pretty well, but nonetheless, we don't know to what extent these online surveys are representative. So that's what we're examining in this paper. So there have been comparisons between web samples and face-to-face samples, and we found, these studies found that the web samples were more likely to overrepresent high earners, owner-occupiers, native English speakers, citizens, those who are more educated, married, and females. But they tended to underrepresent older respondents, married, and better health. So we just saw this with the Uruguay sample. Sometimes the weighting can correct for these differences, but not necessarily. So our initial sample was 86,400. So we sent out that many letters to different households. And we ended up with about a 13.8% response rate. But we did achieve our target of 7,200-something productive cases. We sent out one invitation letter and two reminder letters. And within the households, we asked people to self-select the respondent based on the last birthday method. We also used an experimental design to maximize our incentives. In stage one, we had an experiment sending out 10, 15, and 20 pound vouchers. We found from analyzing this incentive experiment that the 15 pound incentive worked for most of the UK, but we had a targeted 20 pound incentive in deprived areas. Also note that we did an experiment with QR versus a link, but I'm not going to talk about that. Okay. What we're doing in the paper is to compare the distributions against gold standard external benchmark measures with 95% confidence intervals. Our gold standard is really the census, which was conducted in 2021, not too long ago, so it seems like it would be a good benchmark, but it was only conducted in England and Wales. Scotland and Northern Ireland had their own separate censuses, and they're not ready available. They're not ready yet. So for some of our indicators, we have to use the annual population survey, which is a survey. So it's a survey, we're benchmarking against another survey, but nonetheless, we think that it's a good external benchmark. So the average absolute error is based on the Duncan Dissimilarity Index, identifies variables with the largest mismatch while accounting for the number of categories within each variable. There is no real threshold.
But you can think about it as if there's an error of 5, it indicates that 5% of the participants would need to be classified to other categories to match the corresponding reference distribution. So the variables that we pay attention to are sex, age, ethnicity, country of birth, highest education, partnership, in paid work, although that's only at the UK level because we have to use the annual population survey for that. Okay, and then there's cross tabs of age groups by sex and educational level, which I'm not going to show you. So this is briefly what we found. The gray variables are those which are overrepresented, and the red ones are underrepresented. So this is as very commonly found in other surveys, also the other GGSs. So we there are more women than in the census. I'll just summarize quickly. I think we're running out of time. Without weights, the UK GGS is biased towards respondents who are female, white, born in the UK, higher educated, never or not legally married, and for these age groups of 30 to 39 and 50 to 59. Without weights, the average absolute error is about 6 to 7, so it's not great, but it's not too terrible either. The largest mismatch was by sex and education levels, and it was relatively large for partnership status at the UK level. We also found an overrepresentation of childless and single people. And this was rather surprising, and we are trying to construct new weights. We still don't know what the results of these new weights are. So NatSen created some very complicated selection weights, but we are concerned about the differences between single-person households and multi-person households, and so we've asked them to redo the weights to try to see if we can get a better representation of childless and single people. So we hope that within the next couple of months, the UK GGS will be available and deposited at either the UK Data Service and or the, well, definitely the NIDI repository. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, then we stay in the flow and come to the next presentation by Olga Grünwald, who will present joint work together with Art Liefer about non-responsive to daily questions in the GGS.
All right, so my name is Olga Grünwald, and I will present briefly ongoing work with Art Liefer on the topic of non-response to date questions in the second round of the GGS. And so one of the key features of the GGS is the collection of dates, and we as demographers are, of course, very interested in these dates, so they provide valuable insights into the timing and sequences of life course transitions, and this allows us to understand when and in what order life course events occur. And in GGS2, we capture life course transitions such as leaving the parental home, union formation and dissolution, parenthood and retirement. And since we gather information on different life course transitions, we can also explore the interconnections between different life course transitions. However, one issue that we've encountered is that there is a relative high rate of non-response in the date questions, and non-response here is defined as respondents answering don't know or refuse to the date questions. And we observed that there are non-response rates higher than 10% in many date-related questions. So for instance, on average, there are around 25% of respondents who say don't know or refuse to the question on when their parents got married, but also to easier questions such as when the first child was born, we see in some countries non-response higher than 10%. So This might be due to technical reasons, for example, because the way the question was asked, the way the survey was built, or because some respondents got too many questions. But it might also be due to psychological reasons. So, for example, the respondent has a poor memory and does not remember, is not very motivated to think about the date, or has privacy concerns and would not and does not want to share the information. So if we look at the non-response rates from the respondent perspective, we see that the average respondents receive around 30 questions, and respondents do not answer around one or two questions of the date questions that they receive. And so from this perspective, it actually seems a bit less worrying that we have higher rates of non-response to date questions, because it looks like they just skip one or two questions. But what we also see that there is a lot of variation in that number, so how many questions respondents skip. And if we analyze the non-response to date questions in a multivariate way, we can better understand which characteristics of the question and which characteristics of the respondent drive the non-response to date question. And so we run a multi-level model in which the questions are nested within the respondents to combine the technical and the psychological perspective. So for now, we have picked Estonia as an example, and that's what I'm showing you here. So this table shows the odds ratios of non-response for the variable level indicators and the respondent level indicators, and the values above one mean that the odds ratios of not answering a date question is higher, and values below one mean that the odds are lower. And so what we see is that especially if the question is about another person, so for example, about the date of when something happened to the partner or the parents, the odds are six times higher that the question is not being answered as compared to if the question on the date is about the respondent themselves. And what we also see, what I find quite interesting, is what is that the number of questions actually doesn't have a large impact on whether a date question is being answered or not. And if we turn to the respondent level indicators, I'm now showing you just basic socio-demographic characteristics, and we see what I found interesting was that the older age groups are actually less likely to have non-response to date questions compared to the younger groups, and so do the higher educated and women. And so there are certainly several more predictors that one might add to the model to explain non-response to date questions, and this will also be the next step to refine the model further and also to run these models in a cross-country comparison. And most importantly, it will be also interesting to see to what extent there are these differences depending on whether the survey was run in face-to-face or in web. And overall, so this presentation was mainly just to flag the research problem, and I'm looking forward to discussing this further with those who are interested. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Olga. We will now have the last presentation of this flash session. This will be by Laurent Toulemont, and he will present joint work together from other colleagues at INET, and we'll talk about the French DGS pilot. So the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. It's a little late now, so I will try to be as quick as possible. So I will present some the conclusions we made after the pilot in France. So I will be very quick in presenting the test we made. We were lucky enough to have a list of inhabitants, so we could contact people by postal mail, by email, or by telephone. And we tried different possibilities to give incentives to the respondents and to contact them through internet or through telephone. And then the main result was that the overall response rate are very low in France, like in many countries, and incentives do not make any difference by telephone. They make a difference on the internet. And we switched after 1 month and a half. We switched those who were first interviewed on telephone. We offered them the possibility to answer in internet and on the reverse, those who first were offered to answer on the internet, they were contacted by telephone, and this led to a large increase in the response rate. But the main result we found was a very large discrepancy in the response rates by social strata, and we had some information in our administrative file about the wealth, the standard of living, and you see here the dramatic increase of the response rate by standard of living, starting around 10% by telephone up to 40%. And the same, we have the same effect, very similar effect on internet and on telephone. So, and there were on internet many questionnaires that were dropped, that were not finished, that were completed, not completed. So, well, in a nutshell, we estimated some data quality measures, and there were not many large differences in the data quality, but we could say that the data were a little better by telephone, but it was not very large. So we decided not to use monetary incentives because it seemed not to be very efficient, and it was very complicated to implement, and we had many issues, and to run parallel Kawi and Kati, in order to increase the response rate as much as possible. So hope to our administrative file, we will make a large overrepresentation of people with a low standard of living so that the weights will not be will not have too large a variance. And we will run push to web with parallel. We start with SCAWI, and after 2 weeks, we call the people to offer them to finish the questionnaire if they started, or to complete the questionnaire on Kawi, or to answer by telephone. And then we will have 4 weeks by telephone, and then there are 10 remaining days with a final reminder for those who would want to complete the questionnaire on Kawi. So, well, the fieldwork just started, so we are making not all the sample at the same time, and so the fieldwork will take place during 7 or 8 months. So thank you very much. That's it.
Yeah, thank you, Laurent. So as we started a couple of minutes later, we have now enough time to have a short joint discussion, and therefore, sorry, Laurent, I would ask all presenters to come in front so that they can easily answer the questions from the audience. So, are there any questions, comments, or remarks to one of the presenters? And we were too tired waiting for the reception. Okay, I would have a question then. To Olga regarding the date question. My, or it's more a comment on that, because I could imagine, on the one hand, I think maybe it would be good to check or control for general item non response. Well, I do not know if you have done that, because it might be that some respondents just rushed through the questionnaire and skipped a lot of questions, not only daily questions, that you could separate these ones from the ones who refused out of other reasons. And according or related to that, I had also the idea to look at a specific date questions. For example, I could imagine, just to disentangle these effects or reasons you mentioned, like privacy concerns or just like satisfying effects here, to look, for example, at date of birth from the own child. I would here think that persons would recall the birthday of their own child, but maybe they would have here more privacy concerns. Compared to, for example, date questions regarding cohabitation with the third ex-partner or something like this. Here I could imagine that these are not score not so high on sensitivity, but more that someone really does not recall, maybe. So just a question if you check that or control for that.
Yeah, so for the first point, I think that's a good point, and that's something that would be worth looking into. And the second point, so... By if you look at specific questions, you kind of take the variable level non-response, what I showed in the beginning, and we try to take one step back and analyze it more in a general way on what type of question is it really that respondents do not answer. And I think I didn't make it specific in the table or in my presentation was that we also distinguish between whether the question is on a start date or an ending date, whether it's a celebratory event, so something that you celebrate every year and would remember. And we do find differences in that, but maybe there could be also something more to what extent the person is close to you that the question is about rather than more general points. But thanks for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Are there any questions from the audience? Detlef? Oh, is there another question? Oh, sorry, I did not see you though. Yeah, you have the mic.
I have the mic.
You have the power.
My question to Arike, you compared the effectiveness of answering laptop and or smartphone. My question is, do you have any early results regarding the effectiveness of the responses regarding whether they could respond all this kind of how to say, complete complex questions using the smartphone.
So you mean if the data quality of difficult questions were... No, not yet, but I didn't realize that I had already run all these models, so we could very easily, for example, now just merge the because the data on the device is not in our normal data set. We have to merge some paradata, but we can... If I had known, we could have easily done it and checked whether, for example, these dumbbells and refusals for date questions are larger, happen more often and more often.
In this regard, the don't know, also missing guys are included in the don't know, or are they not included? So if a question is not answered.
But you cannot, you always have to answer the question, but you could answer don't know or refuse, but you cannot skip a question. Or is that not what you mean? Yeah. So that's what explained. Yeah.
Okay, then that's
it. Yes, hello. Thanks for these great presentations. One question to Olga. Sorry if I should have missed something which you have already presented. Was there an effect of the position in the interview being rather early or being rather late? I could imagine that towards the end of the interview, you're annoyed enough to just skip those questions.
Yeah, so that's something that I'm also still trying to figure out how to include that into the model, since we kind of take the order of the questions out of the model as the questions are nested within the respondent. But I think it's also worth checking in a descriptive way to what extent is it that if a question comes later, then there is more non-response. But at the same time, we did find that the number of questions really didn't make much of a difference. So whether you get 20 or 40 questions, so in that sense, I would then I would have expected that someone who gets 40 questions has more non-response than someone who gets
fewer questions. And the question to Rico would be, you had this effect of women being more likely to use smartphones. I was still wondering why that is so. Do we have any contact information, for example, do we have information on how many women, how many men own a notebook or desktop computer so that they would be able to use it? Or do you have any other explanation for this gender thing?
No. I mean, I could certainly look into that, but I could imagine, well, in these countries, I think almost everyone has a smartphone. So maybe indeed less women have a private laptop, for example, from work, or that could be an explanation, perhaps. But I didn't look into it, no.
Are there any further questions or comments?
Thank you, everyone. A question to Brianna. You mentioned the £20 incentive group. Maybe the first question regarding that would be whether that was a plan all along in the very beginning, you anticipated that? And I would also be interested to hear more if that really contributed to people in, let's say, more disadvantaged areas in the UK responding to the question. Thank you.
Yes, in stage one, we randomly assigned different small area units the incentives. And so that's how we clustered the incentives by these particular areas. And then we analyzed them and found out that it did seem like there was a slight advantage of using the £15 versus the £20, but on, it was very, very small. So, but in the deprived areas, it looked like it was much more likely that they would respond to the £20. I don't actually know how many deprived areas ended up with the £20 incentive. I should probably look that up. But it does seem to have worked because we did have a slightly higher percent of actual people with low education. Once we had the survey data, we could see that it was the low educated men in particular who responded well to the £20 incentive.
Okay, are there any other questions from the audience? I would have one more question to Laurent. We already talked about this issue today, but I would be interested because you said, okay, you found out that Kati performed best in your experiment. Have you checked the sensitive items then? Because Kati is interviewer administered compared to Kavi, which is not, which is self-administered. Have you had a look at these items because you had an experiment design, therefore you could simply just compare the distributions, for example, for happiness, depression, or any other more subjective or sensitive items in the GGS, or haven't you done this yet?
No, we have not done that yet because of this desirability bias is not so straightforward. It may depend from the social group. There may not be a major bias as you have seen, for instance, in Germany. Our sample, I'm afraid, was too small, despite you used the pilot, so maybe we could check that, but we didn't really.
Okay, so thank you. Okay, if there would be no more questions, last chance. No? Okay, then I would say I would now officially close this first session, and therefore I would say a big thank you to all presenters again, and also a big thank you to the audience. And I think we will now directly go to the small reception. We would be happy if you we'll all join this. I think it's in the room next here, or maybe, yeah. Okay. You want to say something? Okay.
So, thank you for being to this end of this session. And the reception is offered just the front of the room. So we, in the name of the organizational team and my boss, Agnieszka Kuhn-Dominczak, I would like to invite you cordially to this reception. So enjoy. the docks, the drinks, and also the food. Thank you.